afraid that the over-targeting of the Australian social security system, the stigmatising of the poor, has created a situation where we need to think of a radically different approach. And that's why I think it's important that we look at these international experiments on basic income. We think about what might be possible to do in the Australian context. But to continue on with the current trend, which is to reinforce poverty rather than relieve it, I think would be quite wrong.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Later this week, the Melbourne Institute of Applied Economic and Social Research and the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence will sponsor the Henderson Conference, which will look at issues of poverty, inequality, and the future of the social security system. The conference has its historical reference point in the landmark Henderson Inquiry into Poverty, which was done in the 1970s. That inquiry examined the extent of poverty measured against a poverty line, which was set as a benchmark around family needs. Henderson also advocated a guaranteed minimum income scheme, which has echoes in today's international debate about a universal basic income. Ahead of the conference, we're speaking with former Labor Deputy Prime Minister Brian Howe, whose various portfolios in the Hawke and Keating governments included social security and health. He will give an introduction at the Melbourne conference this week. Brian Howe, could you begin by explaining the legacy of that Henderson inquiry?
The Henderson inquiry was incredibly important. It was really the first time in Australia that anyone had looked in a comprehensive way at poverty. In a way, Australia was in a state of denial. It didn't really want to come to terms with the fact that within this lucky country, or so-called lucky country, there was a great deal of inequality and certainly a great deal of poverty. Now, Henderson cracked that myth of the lucky country, and he demonstrated in his research, using a very austere poverty line, that indeed poverty did exist, and existed on a significant scale. He chose a very austere poverty line because he didn't want any argument about the fact that poverty was existing in Australia, and it was a serious problem, especially for aged people at that time, and especially for aged people because, of course, the labour market in the post-war period really had experienced a long period of full employment. And so Henderson found poverty, but especially amongst people who are no longer in the workforce, aged people.
Now, all these decades on, do you think poverty is a greater or lesser problem in relative terms in Australia than when Henderson was examining it?
Yeah, look, it was a much more complex problem today. I'm not sure about greater, but certainly much more complex. In Henderson's time, as I said, poverty mainly affected the aged, and that, of course, the reason for that was the very low level of the age pension. Now, the Whitlam government really established a benchmark of 25% of average weekly earnings, and that in turn influenced rises in the age pension over the Whitlam government period. But, of course, unemployment today is much more important cause of poverty, and not just unemployment, underemployment. We have one of the higher rates of underemployment in the OECD. So, in a sense, we have a very different economy, too. It's an economy I suppose we'd call an information or service economy, an economy in which there's a great deal of work that is casual, that is not paid according to award wages. So, in a sense, there's a more complex problem around the issue of wages and unemployment.
Just in terms of the differences, do you think that there's more intergenerational poverty these days? And are the new factors that which weren't as prominent in the 70s, for example, the role of drugs in causing poverty, I think was probably a good deal less?
Yes, I'm not sure about drugs. I think it's a peripheral issue, really. I think poverty is caused by unemployment, fundamentally, but also the cost of housing is a major cause of unemployment. Australia has never had anything like enough social housing. And so at a time when the price of housing has never been higher, that has a massive impact on lower-income people. Now, I know we have rent assistance, but rent assistance has never been set at a level that would cover the real costs of rent. So it's a contribution towards rental payments. So as rental payments get higher and higher, access to housing becomes a major cause of poverty. That's why Henderson had two poverty lines, one a general poverty line and then after housing cost poverty line, because he saw how important housing was in terms of people's real income. And if that was true then, it's much more true today.
So just on this point about housing, do you think it's a matter of government putting more money into public housing, or do you think that there's also a need for more measures to boost the home ownership rate, which has been declining?
Well, the home ownership rate is certainly starting to decline, and that's, of course, particularly impacting on younger people and first home buyers. So there's a cost there, and so there's an issue there in terms of access to housing for people that have incomes that should allow them to become homeowners. But there's a bigger problem in terms of the inability of successive governments to develop an alternative to home ownership. I think that is a very serious problem. Now, I think the answer to that problem is not going to be just more public housing in the old model. I think the old model has probably run its course, and we need a new model of affordable housing in this country that probably is going to be a combination of public subsidies and private investment.
And how do you encourage that private investment? By low interest loans or what?
I think it's important to encourage the superannuation funds to invest much more in housing. Now, to do that, they need a long-term prospect of long-term earnings from that investment, and the government's got to come to terms with that and arrange a scheme that encourages that form of investment.
There's been a lot of talk recently about Labor embracing the idea of what it calls a living wage. We don't know yet how it's going to do that, what form initiatives would take, but what do you think of that sort of concept?
I think at the moment there's a serious problem because we're not indexing pensions and benefits in the same way against average weekly earnings. We're moving away from that model to a CPI model. Now, that's a price model. Now, effectively, that's going to mean in the long term very serious reductions in all pensions and benefits. And some benefits, of course, benefits as opposed to pensions, are far too low. I think the unemployment benefit's now about two-thirds of the poverty line, massively below the poverty line and massively below overall payments for pensions. Now, that issue is the scandal, really. And successive governments have allowed unemployment benefit and special benefit to drift away, so that it would now cost at least $8 billion and perhaps more than $1 billion to correct that problem. That's why we're thinking about not just trying to address the problems as Newstart as such, but to suggest that we need a different approach, and that's why we're talking about universal basic income.
Well, let's turn to that because it's an area of particular interest to you. Finland, for example, is in its second year of trialling such a program. Can you explain it to us and how you would see it working in the Australian context?
Well, the best way to explain it is really the way that Henderson talked about it. He talked about a guaranteed minimum income. That would, of course, cost money. And so he suggested a change in the way that taxation was applied and a proportional form of taxation. But the idea of a guaranteed minimum income doesn't necessarily need to be comprehensive. It could be focused. For example, when we introduced the families package in the 1980s, that was in a sense a form of not quite universal, but fairly universal income for families. Similarly, if you thought today about youth unemployment, which is a major problem, and there are a range of problems that are affecting younger people, you could have a universal payment directed towards youth that took away the fundamental problem that Henderson really worried about, which was stigma. Now, if the problem of stigma was a problem in the time of Henderson's writing, it's a massive problem today, because people out there in the suburbs tend to think they know how lower income people think, and they tend to stigmatise or have a stigmatised version of who they think might be in poverty. And, of course, that means that we are reluctant to provide the adequacy that's absolutely necessary if we're going to keep people out of poverty.
So you're saying that this basic income scheme would target groups like young unemployed or...
It could do that. I think if you think about young people today, they're very disadvantaged in a number of ways. I mean, they're disadvantaged very often because they find it hard to crack a decent job. They're sitting there on the edge of the labour market. They are incurring increased costs associated with development, have to have a health insurance, have to pay superannuation contributions and so on. They're really in a position where they find it very hard to make any long-term commitments. Even to buy a car can be a massive problem for a younger person in today's labour market. My fundamental argument, and an argument that John Quiggin, the economist from the University of Queensland, will pursue, is that combination of capital and technology has created a totally different labour market than existed, the one that existed in Henderson's day. And in a sense, we go on assuming that the world hasn't changed, whereas the world's changed in quite fundamental ways. And especially it's changed because of the labour market is a much more uncertain, much more risky labour market, especially for young people today.
And, of course, automation will be increasingly taking away a lot of low-skilled jobs over the decades ahead, won't it?
Yeah, I think the digital economy is going to have a massive impact on the distribution of employment. Now, for a lot of young people, life has never been better. It's been wonderful. They are locked in with their mobile phones and their computers, and they're extremely clever and able to, well-educated and able to get jobs. But at the periphery, you've got an increasing number of young people that are doing it very hard because, in a sense, the choices they have are choices, in a way, at the bottom of the labour market. They're working away in the restaurants, in the hotels, in the tourist industry, in industries where the opportunities for them to pursue a career are virtually non-existent. And that tends to mean they just can't think ahead. And, of course, when we pay them benefits at too low a level, in a sense, that destroys their confidence to be able to take risks. So it's counterproductive in the policies that we're currently pursuing. And I'm not talking here about one party. I think across parties, we've pursued a policy which is far too negative. Bob Gregory, in a brilliant article in the Economic Review, Bob Gregory is an economist at ANU, shows how over a long period of time, we've allowed the gap between pension benefits to grow wider. And what that's tended to do is to threaten young people with poverty rather than treating them as people where capability needs to be enhanced and where they need to be given confidence.
Are you talking about a more generous regime in terms of Social Security payments for young unemployed people?
Yeah, we've got to look at how this is done in other countries. For example, in Denmark, they have the highest levels of unemployment benefits and protection in Europe. And yet at the same time, they have young people who are unemployed for a very short period of time. They invest in the young person in training and qualifications, but they also ensure that that young person is treated with real dignity. In Australia, we're stigmatising the most disadvantaged, and we're paying enormous amounts for that. Because if a young person has a bad experience, now, like the recent research at Melbourne University shows, whether it's working as a casual or whether it's on unemployment benefit, those young people will be hurt in terms of their lifetime earnings. Not just in the short run, in the whole course of their lives, they'll pay a cost. We have to reverse current policies, and that means looking at alternatives. And I think in Australia, we've been quite ignorant in terms of not looking at what happens in Scandinavia, for example, where progressive policies produce a very different set of labour market outcomes, especially for young people.
You're not talking about topping up the income of young people who are, say, employed part-time or casually?
I think effectively a GMI would do that. Of course, if it would say that we had a GMI that was focused on the under-25s or some age group like that, then effectively you may want to, you would be effectively topping up their income, not necessarily, which might be part wage, part government. you know, you want to ensure that young people have an adequate income to be able to make some choices about how they live their lives.
How would you reply to those who say, well, this would reduce their incentives to get jobs?
Yeah, I think the incentive argument's been somewhat overused. I think if young people are treated in a stigmatised way, without dignity, then in a sense, any incentive they might have to move forward tends to be crushed. I think the policies of treating young people, you know, it strikes me as extraordinary that a country that regards itself as a liberal thinking country, we're taking away the choices that young people have. Individual choice, we say, is at the heart of the economy. Well, for young people, there are very few choices, and they know it, and they feel stigmatised, and they feel marginalised.
Often I think this basic income scheme is spoken of in the context of workers at the other end of their working life, people in their 50s, 60s, who through changes in the labour market find themselves out of work and unable to get adequate training or just to get back into other jobs. Do you see that as another important cohort?
Yeah, I think with older people that we've tended to see them phasing out of the workforce too soon, and therefore we don't make investments in older people. That's the reason that lifelong learning is very important, because lifelong learning assumes that you'll go on investing in people across the life course. Now, in a sense, for older people where they may not be able to maintain a job or get a job in the discipline, the area that they are, you know, if they're toolmakers, as toolmakers, their capacity for flexibility will depend on being retrained, perhaps later in life. And, of course, there's strong economic arguments for doing that, because if we can continue people in the workforce rather longer, people live longer, then I think we're going to have to invest in people so that they have the skills to be able to work in the future. I don't think that's just a matter of income. I think that's also a matter of training.
So at that end of the work life, it's more important, you think, to have this retraining to keep people in employment rather than just to have a minimum income scheme?
Well, I'm not ruling that out, but I think if you're looking at the problem for older workers, they often require some retraining and some restructuring. And I think we're tending to think of older workers as being phased out of the workforce, or we think they'll just stay in existing jobs. I think that's a more complex problem. But income is a very important part of it. I mean, the notion of putting older people onto unemployment benefit, the current rates of unemployment benefit is extremely harsh, especially when people have had a very good working life, maybe over 35 years or something, and then suddenly you say, well, you're on unemployment benefit at the current levels, well below the poverty line. I certainly don't agree with that.
Now, in terms of a universal basic income, obviously people will say, well, how can this be afforded? Already, even with the existing scheme, the money is a problem. How much do you think it would cost in rough terms? And what would it mean in terms of taxation, increased taxation? Where would you get the money from?
Yeah, look, I think that is an important issue. I think the government at the moment is talking about spending billions and billions of dollars on providing subsidies to capital to presumably employ more people or to grow their enterprises. I think if we're talking about tax packages, well, we should be talking about tax packages in terms of income transfers as well. So that in a sense, it's very easy for people to talk about increasing the minimum wage or to talk about, on the other hand, increasing tax subsidies to business while neglecting the lower quartiles of people, the people at the bottom of the labour market, who are living on such poor remuneration, poor payments, poor benefits.
So, for example, do you think it would be desirable, justified to have a tax shake-up which increased the GST in order to provide more funds to go into the social security system?
Well, I certainly think that it is important to have an integrated tax and social security system. When we're talking about taxes, as we are at the moment, we ought to be talking about the other side of the equation. Now, Bill Shorten's raised the issue of wages. I think wages are important, but it's also important to ensure that people on low incomes are able to maintain their living standard in what is extremely costly circumstance in Australia. We have a very high standard of living for most people, but for people at the bottom of the income distribution, life is increasingly harsh. Now, I think Henderson saw that, and he saw the need to think of tax and social security together. When we had a tax passage in the 1980s, I ensured that there would be important incentives provided for lower income people as part of that package. And I think the time is opportune, not just to think of tax in isolation, but to think of tax and social security as part of a package.
Increasingly over the years under both Liberal and Labor governments, we've seen greater targeting in the social security system. Do you think that this has been a positive or a negative trend, and do you think it's gone too far?
I think it's gone too far. I think Henderson saw that all those years ago. I mean, talking about 50 years ago, Henderson was saying the thing that worries me most about the Australian social security system is it is so targeted. And targeting and stigma go together. Now, in Australia, both sides of politics have the Labor Party love to talk about working families. Well, working families are well and good, but the nature of work is changing. Especially you can see that in terms of gender. We've got a massive shift of women into the workforce today, and that's got all sorts of implications. And with together, that means a great deal more of commodification of caring. It's important to recognise that we're living in a different set of circumstances, and we need to adjust both our tax and social security system to meet those circumstances.
You're implying that Labor is falling down somewhat on the social security side. Do you think this is because it's afraid of putting money in that area and having its opponents say, well, you're living beyond your means or would be as a government? Or do you think there are other reasons for this?
I think we've got caught in, we've allowed to get caught in a trap. And that trap really essentially is to do with attitudes to people who are disadvantaged. Disadvantaged people, as the researcher of the Brotherhood of the Melbourne Institute would show, have really the same values as the community in general. They seek to have a home, to have a family, to live in a normal suburban community and so on. But of course you can't do that without adequate income. And I'm afraid that the over-targeting of the Australian social security system, the stigmatising of the poor, has created a situation where we need to think of a radically different approach. And that's why I think it's important that we look at these international experiments on basic income. We think about what might be possible to do in the Australian context. But to continue on with the current trend, which is to reinforce poverty rather than relieve it, I think would be quite wrong.
So you think Labor is really not being brave enough in this area?
I think both sides of politics have not done enough to reduce the effects of growing inequality in modern economies. And you can't do that without incurring costs, and costs, of course, have to be paid for. I understand that. But it's very important that we, a country is as strong as its most disadvantaged citizens. If they are not really being looked after, then in a sense, ultimately, it will be corrosive of our citizenship, of our belief about ourselves as a modern progressive economy and society.
Just finally, Brian Howe, this conference later in the week in Melbourne will be a deep dive into a number of policy aspects of these various issues. What do you hope will come out of it?
Well, I suppose it's very much about, Michelle, it's about analysing the issue. We've got, I think, some of Australia's best academics in the social economic policy and the social policy area. And I think they're quite capable of not just debating the issues and thinking about them, but also there will be some directions for policy reform. And I think that's very, very important. Governments do need from time to time to refresh policy. Now, we've had a number of reviews of Social Security over a period, the Harmer Review, there's the McClure Review, we had the Cass Review and so on. But even after all these reviews, we have a great deal of poverty and increasing inequality in Australian society. We put a lot of emphasis on the economy, but the economy has to be made to match society so that we have fair shares in the Australian community. At the moment, I think, just as in the United States, we see a Trump emerging basically because people didn't recognise the extent of disadvantage and poverty that existed in large parts of the country.
Brian Howe, thank you very much for talking with us today and all the best for the conference. It sounds as though it's going to produce some interesting material and let's hope there are some politicians listening to the outcomes. And that's all for our Conversations Politics podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back with another interview soon. Goodbye for the moment.